In this next hour, we hear a panel discussion on climate change and what it means for Wisconsin and the world. The speakers are John Young, Professor Emeritus and Director of the Wisconsin Climatology Office, Dan Cornwell, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison, and Jonathan Martin, Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. The talk took place on April 30th, 2016, at the Sequoia Public Library in Madison, and it was sponsored by the Madison Institute. The first to speak is John Young, Director of the Wisconsin Climatology Office. He speaks on understanding extremes, the seamless world of weather, climate variability, and long-term global climate change.
Understanding climate science that goes way beyond just deciding whether the Earth's system is warming at a certain pace or not, or whether Wisconsin is warming at a certain pace. It's a seamless world of chaotic weather and climate, and I'm involved with the Chaos and Complexity Group on campus, so that's my own perspective here. I would just have a few take-home points that I just have, wish that you keep in mind, because I think there's so much discussion in the press that is on the surface of things. And some things I think we have to take into account, especially when we're talking about the climate at a particular region like Wisconsin. First of all, definition. Climate is actually the full statistics of weather processes over a long period of time. And that's what the State Climatology Office is all about, providing that data that allows you to see it and understand it. The statistics of weather are much more than just the average temperature. They're the average precipitation. All of these things are not geographically uniform. Overall, we can say that global warming processes that Dan will talk about are, of course, something you can understand by looking at the globe as a whole, but we're looking at Wisconsin. Wisconsin can get energy transported from the north or to the south, so circulations are part of climate change, of winds. There are regional differences, as I've said, in climate and climate change. Climate change we've known for many years will not be uniform. Climate warming has been going on in the Arctic regions for many, many years, as we know from the sea ice loss records. And that was predicted without any fancy models. In fact, one of my mentors a long time ago made the first computer forecasts exactly of what would happen in the Arctic. But the warming there is much advanced relative to other places. Also, the trends are not uniform by season. You can't just sort of say it's going to get 3 degrees warmer in Madison over the next 50 years. It'll get 3 degrees warmer in the winter, 3 degrees more in the spring, 3 degrees more in the summer, 3 degrees in the fall. Not true, okay? The climate system has its own seasonality, so that it will have its own warming scenario. And even time of day. Lastly, all of this that is of great interest to people that are worried about what's going to are going to be the trends of the extremes. So to put this in another take home, I want to just remind you that of the size of the changes that we talk about when we talk about climate and climate variability and weather. We know, of course, the seasonal temperatures change depending upon the year. That's the biggest one, seasonal changes. Daily, 10 degrees plus or minus, next largest one. Next is day-to-day, week-to-week weather patterns, typically on the order of plus or minus 8 degrees that we can have for shifts when cold fronts come by replacing warm air. Then comes climate variability, like an El Niño winter versus a La Niña winter and things like that in Madison. This last winter was relatively warm, as you know. That all these things, seasonal, daily, and weather and climate variability, all are big, noisy players in the crowd that is ultimately trending upward to produce climate change trends over the next 50 years. This is part of the problem that we have with public discourse over climate change, that there are all these things going on, so people jump to conclusions and don't see the big picture. This is the year 2012. So 2012 was warm, especially, guess where? That was the year that we had a record warmth in March that killed the cherry crop in Door County, for example, and many things. This is a standout on the globe. Sometimes climate variability that comes and goes could be concentrated over a huge area, and that will have a huge impact on economy and on agriculture and things like that. Now let's go to the very next year, 2013. There's much the same, except that it turns out the middle part of the United States, just one year later, is below normal temperatures, colder than it was for many, many years on the average of 50 years. Okay? Not a lot colder, but colder. Definitely that year, climate warming for Wisconsin and for central United States was not something that was going to be just representing a continuous warming trend. That's the nature of weather and climate, space and time variations. But looking at the trends, and this is important, global average temperatures over from 1880 all the way to the modern times, it is increasing. The rate of increase sort of had a pause about 10 years ago, and the climate skeptics jumped on that. But now you see that that pause has been led to a renewal of this. Another point is if we go down to Madison or Wisconsin temperatures, here's the same kind of pattern here for Wisconsin. There is a trend upward in temperatures, but that there's a lot of fluctuations from year to year. That's part of the noise I talked about before, climate variability. The other thing I have done here is then by smoothing these curves with a time smoother, take out the big fluctuations. We can take out the fluctuations, but those fluctuations are important, you know. Those fluctuations, for example, in the 1930s indicate warming climate, which had to do with the Dust Bowl years. And it was very substantial, and that's what we call interdecadal variability. The atmosphere and the ocean together act sometimes to give a change of climate that is an oscillation that lasts years. And you see those oscillations, but you also see climate change very clearly. The kind of variability we had that really went in the face of global warming is when we had one of our coldest, longest winters ever in 2013 and 14. And it was centered on Wisconsin, not the whole U.S. Last point I want to make is sometimes we'll have what I call two different kinds of winters, two chapters of the same winter, that the first half will be very warm or very cold, and the second half will be cold or warm. Here's the year 2000, December. I don't know whether you remember this, but I remember it very distinctly. It was almost the coldest December on record. And the next month, it was warm. It's a flickering that we sometimes have that lasts for an entire month of the weather patterns, which really is this noisy kind of concept that we were talking about. The flickering is important, but it's added on top of global change. And so we have to keep that back in our mind. It's a very complex system. Precipitation, really important variable, as important as temperature for global change. And we've had an upward trend in precipitation in the world where it normally rains. We've had a downward trend of precipitation in the world where it normally doesn't rain. This is accentuating the extremes of precipitation. The rich places that have climates that have a lot of rain associated with them are getting richer, and the poor climates, the desert sub-Saharan regions, for example, are getting, if anything, a bit drier. This is a world problem. That's why global change is so important for the world, precipitation. Precipitation on a regional basis is also important because this is what we see a lot of extremes occurring in, and I spent some time in recent years trying to think about this a lot. But the bottom line is, first of all, to think about extremes, we are concerned about extremes in local regions. We're concerned about an extreme here in southern Wisconsin, not northern Wisconsin, not in Denver, but local ones. And you have to think about the fact that there's a conspiracy of simultaneous occurrences, which really is responsible for extremes. A certain amount of climate change, a larger amount of natural oscillations like El Nino or La Nina years, and even larger, John Martin's specialty, weather events. Okay? Those things, when they add together, are what break or set an all-time record and exceed thresholds for impacts, where you kill off a cherry crop or you cause the plant hardiness zones to change. You know, they have been drifting upward. We're at a higher zone than we used to be. The probability is all about it. I'm very interested in probability distributions of the climate. But there's a lot of applications that have to do with agriculture, energy, health. Jonathan Patz is a professor on campus that deals with health issues during climate change. And a lot of work we do with trying to look at discussions. I have a little list of what I consider unexplained things. And for years, I've been wondering about the related question, why have Wisconsin's summers been getting, if anything, a bit cooler? We have fewer temperatures exceeding 90 degrees in the summer than we did 20 years ago. I think most of us are aware of that. Not as aware as we would be if we had no air conditioning, but I think most of us have air conditioning. So there's several unexplained things. We have to have science go to work to explain better why was there a hiatus in global warming? Why did the temperatures stop warming for a while? The skeptics jumped all over that, and now it's been resumed. We think it has to do with interdecadal variability, but we have to prove it. Why are summers cooler? My theory is we have more clouds in the summer. It doesn't take a lot, but if the cloudiness increases by frequency or coverage by 10% in the summertime, it keeps you from breaking the records on temperature. So there's lots of things. All that list I started this talk with demands that science get into a deeper understanding of why these things, such as cool summers. By the way, the cool summer business is just in Central America, Central North America. It's not all over the world. Anyway, thank you.
Next, we hear from Dan Cornwell, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison. His talk is titled, Timelines for Climate Change, Projections of Physical Science and Human Responses. Dan Cornwell.
Since climate change is a controversial subject, I thought I should begin with disclosure of a personal bias. I'm against it. Just 8 days ago, representatives, or rather leaders, I should say, of 175 countries met and signed the Paris Agreement. So we have a framework after 20 years of trying for dealing with climate change on an international scale. The question is, will we move quickly enough? Because there's much flexibility in the system that was set up. What I'd like you to think about is timelines. First, for climate change as projected by the physical sciences. And secondly, for the timescale of human responses. Just a word at first about the energy budget of the Earth. Of course, there's energy coming in by radiation from the sun. The Earth is warm enough that it's radiating to outer space, and so you have energy going out. And if what comes in and goes out on the average is the same, the energy of the Earth is the same and the temperature is the same, average. But if for some reason, let's say the energy going out is reduced and the balance is upset, then you have more energy, you have an energy gain by the Earth, and some of that will go into temperature increase, which is troublesome. Since the Industrial Revolution, with the burning of fossil fuels, we've added about 40% to the concentration of carbon dioxide. There's only a small amount there anyway, but that's very important, that kind of an increase. And we know that carbon dioxide traps infrared, so it interferes with our radiation to space. Well, it does nothing to prevent the incoming energy from the sun. So the net effect is the energy of the earth begins to increase, and some of that increase has gone into temperature. I want to talk about some recent measurements, that is a decade ago. Direct measurements of this energy increase. We knew for a long time it was going on, but this was the first time they actually measured it. They measured the temperature of the ocean, sampled it at thousands of locations from the surface down to the deepest part, which is 5,000 meters below the surface. By satellites and in other ways, they measured the melting of ice. And of course, they measured the temperature at the continents on land. And when they put all these numbers together, they found that the temperature, total temperature, they verified that it really is increasing. It's a small amount, but it's important. And these measurements also show the distribution. 88% of the increased energy went into the oceans. 8% went into melting of ice, and 4% into increasing temperature at the surface of the land. Now, if we look ahead, let's look at the time scale for temperature change. The temperature change has been about 8/10 of a degree Celsius, but we know from the amount of carbon dioxide now in the atmosphere, we would expect, even if we stopped all emissions, the temperature to go up another 0.5 degrees Celsius. Of course, we're not going to stop. But the point is that there's a long time. It's likely to take decades for that temperature change to occur. Now, if you have a temperature, if you know it's going to be go up to a certain level, as long as the temperature is below that ultimate, the Earth is gaining energy, and a lot of things are happening, some seen and some not seen, all troubling.
You're listening to Climate Change, What It Means for Wisconsin and the World. The speakers are John Young, Director of the Wisconsin's Climatology Office, Dan Cornwell, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison, and Jonathan Martin, Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison.
There are really a couple reasons why the energy coming in doesn't all go to raising the surface temperature. Because the melting of ice I mentioned, but also oceans. Energy that goes to the top, that comes in from the sun to the top of the ocean, raises the surface temperature, and of course, we're aware of that. Slowly, some of that heat moves into lower levels of the ocean. When it's down there, it doesn't contribute to temperature change. The point is, you may not like the temperature change, but you need to realize the only way the temperature will stabilize is if the surface temperature does go up. That is, you have to go up to that point where it's rebalanced. Until it goes up, we're continually receiving more energy. Let's look at the other effects of the energy coming in. The melting of ice I mentioned, one of the effects of that, melting of glaciers and ice shields, Greenland and so on, that goes into the seas, raises sea level, and of course that's of concern. I also mentioned that some of the heat goes to the lower depths of the ocean. It's important to bear in mind that the ocean will expand as it gets warmer. It doesn't matter where the heat goes, the ocean will expand. So the heat that doesn't remain at the surface and goes down, we don't see that as a temperature change, but it is causing the ocean to expand. And so sea level rise is going on, even though the temperature of the surface isn't rising as much as we might have expected. So the lesson from all this is that the effect of our emissions goes way beyond the time they come out. If you think of the emissions, say, that were coming of carbon dioxide and other gases, in a period of a month, the carbon dioxide quickly mixes with the atmosphere, and so you have it spread up there. Matter of days. But it takes decades for the temperature change to occur that will result from that. So the take-home message for science policy is, I should say for energy policy, is it's not enough just to reduce emissions to where they were a decade or two ago. The policy must be toward zero emissions. That is where we're getting our power for power plants principally from renewable energy sources, our transportation energy provided primarily from renewable sources. And I think a lot of policymakers don't appreciate that. Now, a few words about the timeline of human responses. They began really on a global scale with the adoption of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. 1992, it was recognized there that global warming, climate change was a serious problem. And the nations who signed up to that, and there were almost 200, agreed that climate change should be, if possible, limited to 2 degrees centigrade, if possible, below that. But that nations would meet from time to time and try to agree on curbing greenhouse gas emissions and take other steps to hold the temperature increase to that level. There followed 20 years of meetings which saw very little progress. The problem being, of course, that the developing countries felt that the developed countries had gotten to a high standard of living, putting a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which was going to be there, causing further change for decades. And they felt the developed nations should take the first step in reducing emissions. Of course, developed countries, especially I might say the United States, reluctant to do that because some of the initial investment might be costly. So the breakthrough came just a year ago. President Obama met with General Secretary Jim Zeng of China, and they agreed to use a new approach where China would reduce its emissions relative to GDP. So it would continue to grow, but in growing, it would shift toward more use of renewables than the developed world had done in its growth. The U.S. agreed to reduce emissions on an absolute basis. The hope was that other nations would follow, and indeed they did. They were invited to submit, each nation was invited to submit its own proposal for what it would do, setting its own standard, and when it came in advance of the Paris conference, 188 nations did submit such proposals. And at the Paris conference in December of this past year, there were negotiations. Everybody saw everybody else's proposals, and a set was agreed. The time to sign for that, the nations were given several months to think about it. And this signing that I mentioned occurred then. Leaders of most of the countries signed the Paris Agreement. Now it becomes binding after ratification. Each country has to ratify. But after ratification, the agreement becomes binding. So each nation then is bound to follow its plan. And there's a requirement for it to monitor, each nation monitoring its own emissions and so on. There were other things involved, but emissions are the main feature. So we don't know. There's flexibility because the nations can continually change their plans, and they're certainly reviewed every 5 years. But the agreement is they'd only change in the direction of making them more strict. The hope is that the publics of each country, as they see these changes, as they may be seeing worse effects from climate change, and they're also seeing that countries are beginning to work on it, the hope is public support will increase. In fact, nations may feel pressure from their own publics to stay on track and improve. Were the commitments large enough? The best estimates are that if each nation stuck to its proposals, the temperature, average temperature, would still rise 3 degrees, maybe 4. That's very bad. What we've experienced so far, 0.8 degrees. So multiply that to get up to this higher level. So that's very dangerous. So no, the agreements won't get us where we need to go. However, it's a step, it's a framework, there's possibility of improving it. And so I think we can hope that things will go forward. Sometimes people ask, what can a citizen do? Put on a sweater? Turn down the thermostat? I will tell you what I think a citizen should do. Pay attention. Talk to your friends and your family. When politicians are coming around during the next election, ask them. Climate change wasn't mentioned, as far as I know, in the Republican presidential debate. And certainly many of them are hostile to the United Nations, we know that. But we'll see how things evolve. So the citizen needs to push in these directions and vote.
And finally, we hear from Jonathan Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. His talk is titled, Systematic Shrinking of the Northern Hemisphere's Wintertime Cold Pool. This is one of the newest pieces of evidence to suggest that the planet is warming. Jonathan Martin.
I want to tell you today briefly about what I think is a brand new piece of evidence, and that is that the globe is warming up, subtly but inexorably. And I'm going to focus on the wintertime in the Northern Hemisphere, because I think many times people are thinking, well, you know, you hear about it in the news a lot in the summertime when there's a heat wave anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. Well, that's global warming. Or if there's a spot where a Senator Inhofe last year brought a snowball onto the Senate floor in late February, claiming that because there was snow in Washington, D.C., there couldn't be such a thing as global warming. Other people have said there's been a global warming hiatus since 1998. There's plenty of evidence that says that's absolute nonsense. No one has particularly focused on temperatures measured above the surface of the Earth, and I'm going to do that just with about a mile above the ground, but with particular emphasis on the wintertime. And so doing that, I think, confronts both of those time sort of lines of criticism directly. And it turns out it's been a really interesting journey for me. And I must say I stumble into this problem of thinking about the climate system because, as John mentioned, my particular interest is on weather systems, particularly winter weather systems. So this has not really been where I had my training, but if you spend 25 or 30 years in a career that deals with the atmosphere, you almost can't help but start to learn some things on the periphery of what you thought was your original and maybe sole expertise. So I want to tell you about this, and I call it the canary in the climate coal mine. I think the wintertime speaks loudly about what's happening around the whole globe throughout the year. And I think if you particularly focus on it, sometimes you see things you wouldn't have seen otherwise. We live on this beautiful planet. It's a gorgeous place. There's almost no one who's going to argue with that. But it's a very complex, finely balanced place. We have an atmosphere that's composed of dozens of gases. 98 point something of every breath you fill your lungs with is either molecular nitrogen or oxygen. That's it. And then everything else is very, very fractional, including carbon dioxide. Has risen from about 280 parts per million, so molecules per million in any volume, in about 1790, 1800, beginning of the industrial era, until now we've crossed over the threshold to 400. We have an organization here in town called 350, right, Madison? We're already 50 parts per million above that. So we've got some problems. But that's a small fraction of our atmospheric composition, and yet it has a huge, it's the thermostat, one of the thermostats on our atmosphere's temperature. So there's some implications for screwing around with the composition of the atmosphere. Before I show you my brand new piece of evidence, I want to alert you to one that maybe has not made much headway into the public perception, but it has made headway into people's view of global climate change at the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change level and other levels like that. And that's work by our own John Magnuson at the University of Wisconsin, who is in the Center for Limnology. So John's been interested in this problem for a long time. And around the year 2000, he published a paper in Science that looked at 38 different sites in the Northern Hemisphere where there's a long history of lake ice duration for a wintertime. So ice comes on at a certain day at these lakes like Lake Geneva, let's say in Switzerland, and ice goes off at a certain day. So the first thing he did is he collected as many of these sites as possible around the Northern Hemisphere, then made sure that he didn't have clusters of them only, and made sure they were distributed rather evenly across the whole Northern Hemisphere. Going through those couple of filters, he ends up with 38 different sites that have at least 150-year-long record of ice duration for the wintertime. And he finds out when he does the analysis of those long-term trends that on average over the Northern Hemisphere, again, widely distributed set of lakes, the ice is going on almost 9 days later than it used to in 1845, and it's coming off nearly 10 days earlier than it used to. When I first came to Wisconsin in 1994, I was hearing rumblings about this. The lake ice is a really interesting way to think about how the climate's changing. And I remember being skeptical. Maybe we even talked about this. I remember being skeptical. I used to think this. Well, wait a minute. You could have a really severe cold outbreak in late November in Madison and put ice on Lake Mendota. That's not really a climate change signal. But it's exactly like what John Young was talking about. There's internal variability mixed in with long-term trends. And it seems to me that the more you average over a wide area, the more you get rid of that variability and you start to see maybe what really is the thread of the trend. This analysis is very compelling. And when you then superpose this Northern Hemisphere result on top of our own Lake Mendota, which is the most studied lake in the world, imagine that. That includes Lake Victoria, the headwaters of the Nile. Lake Mendota has been studied more than any other lake in the world. How many people knew that beforehand? Just a few, yeah, just a few. What a large number in this crowd. I'll bet you ask people around the state, they'd say, no way is that true. But that's true, and that's a testimony to the greatness of the University of Wisconsin. It's not just studying it for weather and climate issues, for a variety of other issues. But anyway, look at this long-term trend from 1856, I think, or so, till I had to abbreviate it in 2008. This is from John's Wisconsin State Climatology Office. And then I've put a five-year smoother on it. You see there's a downward trend in the length of the ice duration on Lake Mendota. And the 18 days that is the global or the Northern Hemisphere average from the Magnuson work is about 20% of the average season for ice duration on Lake Mendota. So imagine that. You're cutting the ice duration by a fifth on Lake Mendota in the long-term average. Wow. Unbelievable.
You're listening to Climate Change, What It Means for Wisconsin and the World. The speakers are John Young, Director of the Wisconsin's Climatology Office, Dan Cornwell, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison, and Jonathan Martin, Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison.
So that's one relatively new piece of evidence that points in the same direction, that the globe is warming with particular emphasis here on the Northern Hemisphere. But I have a brand new one that I want to tell you about. This was motivated by a really boring winter for me. I mean, I grew up in New England. That's why Fred and I share the Red Sox as a interest. Recently paid off in spades in that interest, as we'll both agree, but that's another issue. Maybe even this year, Fred. Keep your eye on them. It was a boring winter. It wasn't snowing. It wasn't cold in Madison. But it was cold in Northern Europe, even far Southern Europe. It snowed in Tripoli, Libya this year, 2011-12. And that's relatively rare. It was bitterly cold in Alaska. And I remember thinking, midway through the winter, we have a Friday afternoon weather discussion every week in the department, which you're welcome to attend. It's at 12:15 in room 811 in our building. I remember thinking and announcing, I'm sick of my parochial view. I got to stop thinking about how severe the winter is by just where I live. I'd had some experience living vicariously through winter weather in New England in the 30 years or so since I moved away from there. And so that's been a talent that I've been able to develop. So I thought, I'm going to expand that talent to the globe, the whole hemisphere anyway. And I thought, I've got to get out of this parochial view of the fact the winter's boring in Madison, maybe it's not so boring anywhere else. And I thought, what can I do to measure the severity of the wintertime in a very, very simple-minded way? So this is the temperature minus 5 degrees Celsius, 23 Fahrenheit, at 850 millibars, which is a level in the atmosphere about 1 mile above sea level. So you can plot this 4 times a day from analyses that are done globally by a variety of international weather services, ours being one of them. They have international cooperation, is what I mean by that. And then you can just figure out what the area enclosed in the shaded region is every day. And then I thought, well, maybe there's a trend in that area. You know, if I look at every February 2nd for the last 67 years, is there any trend in how big this area of this particular threshold of cold air is over the hemisphere? I had no idea, so I set out to find out. And when you start playing around with these long-time data sets, the NCEP, the National Center for Environmental Prediction, has a 67-year-old reconstruction of observations taken since January 1st, 1948. And it's a pretty good set of observations, for, especially for my purposes, above the surface temperature analyses. This is the coldest December, January, February moment in that 67-year history. So this is where the minus 5 isotherm was on January 21st, 1984. That's a lot of the hemisphere and a lot of North America. Look at that. It's minus 5 or colder as far south as Houston. Pretty unbelievable. And then this is the smallest such area in December, January, February, and that was in 2003. So that's a lot different. Okay, so that's just for fun. Then you can say, how about 4 different other thresholds, minus 5, minus 10, minus 15, all the way down to minus 25, and then the calendric dates, and then the area in millions of square kilometers. Of course it would be like that. This is the long-term average, because this area expands and contracts with the coming and going of the winter season. So you can see it peak in the wintertime and then go away to nothing on the periphery in the summer, and it's beautiful. I mean, if you had to guess what these were going to look like, this is what you'd guess. But this is the long-term average. So I have 90 days, I don't count leap days. December has 31, January 31, 28 in February. 90 days for every winter season from 1948-49 all the way to the last one, 2015-16. And I have 4 times daily areas I can calculate. I average 4 times 90, 360 areas for each winter season. That's the annual, the December, January, February average aerial extent of this cold air, this minus 5 or colder air at 850 millibars. From 1948-49 to the present time, undeniably there's a downward trend. And that trend is significant at the 99.9% level, which means there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that it happens like this by accident. So there's effectively no chance that's an accident. This is testifying to something real that's happening in our atmosphere. How can you make, this is the question I had, how can you make the aerial extent of cold air a mile above the ground get systematically smaller? There's no way to do that with just weather systems operating on the periphery, because weather systems, all they'll do is move it north and south. They won't actually create or destroy cold air. So the only way to explain it, I can see, is that you have an additional retention of infrared energy that warms the planet sufficiently to account for this gradual but systematic shrinking of the cold air mass. And it happens at every one of the threshold levels. The February extent of the northern hemisphere sea ice has had a downward trend that is precisely at the same rate as the downward trend in the aerial extent of the cold air. So these are hand to glove, and people have been talking for about the last 10 years or so, well, the midwinter Arctic sea ice is a real signal of the planet warming up. So this thing fits perfectly with that. And it's free from the surface temperature contamination. A lot of the critics will say, well, when you take a long-term average of the temperatures at the surface, they'll say, well, you move your thermometer from the airport to downtown and so on, that's got contamination. Scientists always reply correctly that, well, we take that into account, we make adjustments to take account of that, but the critics are never satisfied with that response, even though it's accurate and it's done carefully. This doesn't even have to, you don't even have to mount that response. So it's really a nice thing to walk around and talk about. Here is another way of looking at it. In the last 3 years are the last 3 winters. The 2 before the one we just experienced were back-to-back all-time record lows for the cold aerial extent, which is unbelievable, particularly since the first of those 2 record winters was desperately cold here in North America. So there's a whole other jumble of problems to try and figure out. How do you get such a regional disparity between what's going on globally? But boy, this is exactly what I was hoping I'd find when I set out here, because this completely destroys the parochial view that one might acquire, either in a boring winter, which motivated this, or in a really good winter when it's cold and snowy and persistently so, hemisphere is doing something totally different. So that's interesting to me. And you can look at individual days in individual winters in a time series. The second half of that winter in 2011 and 12 was way colder than average over the hemisphere. Started out maybe a little bit near average. Then we almost never even touched the average on every single calendar day in that winter, maybe with the exception of somewhere in the middle of December. So that was an exceptionally, unusually warm winter by this measure. As I said, it was the first of two consecutive all-time minima in terms of the aerial extent. And then another thing you can do, which is fun, is to define extreme cold days as days where the aerial extent of this measure is two standard deviations bigger than the average. So that's fairly substantially bigger than the average. Not many things fall into that category. Warm days would be days exactly compared to individual calendar days where you have an aerial extent that's smaller by two standard deviations than the average for that day. So you can kind of see, even by looking at the dates, the cold events seem to front load the whole time series, and then the warm events are at the back end. There have been 117 days in the last 67 years, in December, January, February, where the aerial extent of the minus 5 air at 850 has been that much larger than normal for the same calendar day. Not a single one of them has occurred since John Young and I met at the airport to begin my interview for this job. 1994, not one. And then there's been 187 days that are on the warm side, 104 of them since 2000. Okay, so this is really telling, and I've got a statistic for you near the end here that's really interesting. Over the last 67 years, the Northern Hemisphere, December, January, February, average area occupied by air colder than about 23 Fahrenheit, a mile above the ground, has decreased by about 5%. And every time you say this to a crowd, they gasp, and then there's some skeptics. I was in Orange County earlier this month, and really nice conversations with people who are still kind of on the fence or skeptical about this problem. And they said, 4.5%, that doesn't sound like much. And I said, what if your portfolio went down 4.5%? What would you say then? You know, and then they said, oh, yeah, I guess you got a point there. Shrinking cold air. The shrinking cold area most likely a result of greenhouse warming. I can't think of another physical reason that could compel this to be so systematic. And that's passed the scrutiny of reviewers in this paper's published in the Journal of Climate now. So that's encouraging as well. Here's the stat. Extreme cold events have stopped happening, while extreme warm events have flourished. The score since I took my job at the University of Wisconsin, 141-0. That's a whitewashing of epic proportions. Okay, Cubs got off to a great start this year. Everyone's excited about them. They're not going to find themselves in late September at 141-0. Okay, that's just astounding if you think about it in sports terms. But scientists are a skeptical bunch. It took a while for this paper to get through review. We all expect that when we submit things. It's not going to be easy. So I just want to finish by pointing out that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has made now five assessments. The second one I'm going to quote first, that's from 1995, and it said regarding human influence on changing the climate, especially the global average temperature, that the balance of evidence suggests that there is a discernible human influence on global climate. That's a pretty vanilla statement, I think you'd agree. But it's saying something nonetheless. But boy, it's hesitant, really, really careful. And that's because scientists are skeptical. They don't just accept things. They don't just assert things. They want to find proof. And there's thousands of people, literally, working on this project around the globe. So what you do in the interim is you do more observations and do more analysis and refine your thinking. And then in 2001, a full 6 years of effort later, here's the similar statement that came out of that assessment. Most of the observed warming over the last 50 years is likely to have been due to the increase of greenhouse gas concentrations. I've highlighted the word likely because maybe some of you have had the misfortune of having to be on committees during your professional careers and whatever it is you might do. Imagine this. There was a committee of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to determine the definitions of several adverbs. Imagine more boring committee work than that. I mean, that is one of Dante's circles, it would seem to me, right? But here's the definitions that came out. Likely meant 60 to 70% probability. So still, close to vanilla, a little bit less than vanilla this time. More refined observations and analysis. You wait till 2007 for the next one. Similar statement. Most of the increase in globally average temperature since the mid-20th century is very likely due to the observed increase in anthropogenic greenhouse gas concentrations. Very likely was meant to be about 80% probability. so a little bit higher. And that was agreed upon 6 years earlier. So they weren't moving the goalposts. And then more observations, 2013. It is extremely likely. Greater than 90% probability is what that means. In fact, it might be 95%. It is extremely likely that human influence has been the dominant cause of observed warming since the mid-20th century. So you take 1,000 skeptical scientists, more than 1,000 skeptical scientists, who are competing for the same sort of high profile. They want to be the one who's delivered the message. And over a period of 18 years, you finally get a consensus to say it's extremely likely. That means that this debate is over. Okay, this debate's over. We have other debates that we should enjoin. How do we proceed from here? But this fact is now established. And anybody who argues about this being factual is wasting your and their time, because we have other problems we could work on together to solve. So thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to Climate Change, What It Means for Wisconsin and the World. It was a panel discussion featuring John Young, Director of the Wisconsin Climatology Office, Dan Cornwell, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison, and Jonathan Martin, Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. The talk took place on April 30, 2016, at the Sequoia Public Library in Madison, and it was sponsored by the Madison Institute. The Madison Institute is a policy study center in the progressive tradition. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.